your cruel device, your blood like ice. One look could kill my pain. Your thrill. I wanna love you, but I better not touch.
It's not often I get a chance to play Poison on Life Matters. Well, Alice Cooper singing Poison, and Poison, or rather Venom, this is our excuse, happens to be the lifelong interest of my next guest, Dr. Brian Greg Fry. He is the Venom doc. He's just written a terrific memoir, which he describes as like David Attenborough on acid, and I think he's probably right. Yes, it's an unusual life that he recounts. He's Associate Professor at the University of Queensland School of Biological Sciences, where he's group leader of the Venomics. Was it Venomics? Venomics yeah. Laboratory. And he joins me in the studio. In fact, Alice Cooper's sort of quite relevant to some of your field work, I think.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to my nightmare.
You're a metalhead as well,
oh,
I think.
Yeah, yeah. We always have the metal music playing while we're out in the field, somewhere in the deep desert.
It's classic.
Yeah.
Now, look, one reason why you can work with deadly animals is that you have very little fear and you had an early brush with death. That is perhaps an explanation for that. Take us back to your childhood, an unusual childhood, I think.
Yeah, my first memory is actually being in the hospital bed strapped down because I had spinal meningitis, which, of course, is something that just strikes a cold, you know, grip on the heart of any doctor or patient, you know, to hear this diagnosis. You know, it's something that is lethal, and there's two forms of it, one of which hits just infants, and the other form hits, you know, anyone of any age. So I had the infant-only version. And I have scars on either temple where they inserted tubes into me and I was pulling them out. So they had to strap me down. And so my first memory is just of this agony, you know, from 16 to 20 months, you know, in the hospital. And then that left me with deafness in my right ear. And so I had this early brush with, you know, this concept of toxin where, you know, and then some magic happens and the rest of your life is never the same.
Mm.
You know, you're damaged in some way. You know, so it was fascinating to me in that regard. And then when I started seeing pictures of like when my mom was living in Egypt when she was growing up, because her parents were Norwegian diplomats, so they lived all over the world. And they had cobras, you know, they had Gaboon vipers coming through, you know, when they lived down in Gabon, you know, so they were showing me pictures of these animals and they're just so beautiful because, you know, they're very geometric. Yeah. Mm. So they're from an aesthetic perspective, just gorgeous creatures. Mm. And something about my personality also drew me to working with these kind of predators where.
Fearless.
Well, not so much that. It's more that I understand what they're doing. So I have a simple philosophy that takes a lot more skill to keep an animal calm than it does to piss it off and then into a provoking it into a defensive response and screaming about how dangerous it is.
Mm.
So it might be that, you know, basically you could think of it that these snakes are like sociopaths is the best way to describe them. And I'm very much in Asperger's place, and Aspergers are, you know, immune to the charms of sociopaths, you might say. Our complete obliviousness is the kryptonite to these kinds of things. So these animals, well, you know, I have personal interactions that kind of fit that definition too. But, you know, these kinds of animals, I'm just drawn to the sort of this dance of death with them, not of necessarily because I'm suicidal, but I just find them so creature, you know, so wonderful that these are the creatures that I love, you know, so my passion becomes the fuel, because with any kind of scientist, it's, I would not recommend science as a career at all to anybody unless they loved what they were doing, mm. because it's such a manic, depressive existence with uncertain career path, drip feeding funding, you know, all of these things conspiring against you. That
the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, indeed. In some respect. But just take us back briefly to your childhood. What did you bring home?
Oh, everything. You know, if I could catch it. You know, so I've had my own little mini zoos all my life, you know, and it's like when I moved out to go to university and my parents found that A, I had a king cobra in my bedroom that they never went to anymore, and that it was B, 5 meters long, you know, amongst many other things. You know, so they knew I had a lot of stuff. They knew I had venomous animals, but they hadn't quite appreciated
what
the
did they
insanity
think of that,
that's
though? It. What did they think of that? That you wandering out with your cargo shorts and a snake bite kit, you know, as a kid.
Yeah. Well, it helps that my mom's side of the family is very unusual. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of forgiveness, you know, for eccentricity in this regard. So like the composer Edvard Grieg is a relative of mine. We have, you know, a lot of very strange but talented people on her side of the family. So I fit right in. And so they were really cool. It wasn't the career that they would have chosen for me, but they were the nevertheless supportive, you know, even when I was, you know, this insane little child. So they were, you know, they didn't say things like my father turning to my mother and saying, you know, that the boy is deranged, we need to see a psychiatrist, I told you not to drink during pregnancy. could have been possible reactions.
That's right. We'll let him keep his 5 meter python in his bedroom. Because interestingly enough, when you were four, you said, I'm going to work with snakes. And indeed you did. Despite what you were bringing home, though, it took quite a while for you to receive your first venomous bite, and you've received quite a few since, and your description of these are fairly phenomenal. They're a psychotic, hallucinatory sort of experience, aren't they? Describe your first bite. And it was the Stevens banded snake, I think it was, from memory.
Oh, the first bite was actually an American rattlesnake. But with any of these things, the first thing that happens is the wave of emotion that hits your heart with this almighty clong, you know, as you're staring in disbelief at something very tangible, two drops of blood. Mm. There, you know, denial will only carry you so far. And, well, maybe it didn't get any venom in me, because actually, you know, a lot of snake bites are actually what we call dry bites in that they don't have venom. So with this particular one, characteristic of rattlesnake bites is basically turning your arm into black goo. You know that saying, as long as it doesn't turn black and fall off, it'll be all right. Well, with rattlesnakes, often it's not all right without treatment. So we were thinking, all right, well, we'll see if there's any symptoms. There weren't. You know, there's no local symptoms at all. But this is a very unusual one that we got, where it was from the Florida-Georgia border, beautiful pink rattlesnake. And it turns out that this particular population happens to have venom that is neurotoxic instead of the usual local symptoms. So I started driving home. I was at a mate's place buying it off him.
Thinking you were okay.
Yeah, thinking, oh, good.
You were so not okay.
The first thing that happened was I lost my ability to see color, where it was a monochromatic world. It was just shades of yellow from white to black. And I'm looking around and just thinking, uh-oh. Because, you know, I'm just knowing this is not good. I hadn't heard of the symptom, but one does not need to be an Oxford Don to realize that no good is going to come out of something like this. Then I got a strange metallic taste, like my mouth is made of living metal, and then just went into this sensory vortex, you know, that's like a bad LSD trip. You know, this is not the fun kind of hallucinations. You know, sounds are distorting, shapes were not quite there. And then I pulled over, told the lady at the counter of a convenience store that I had been bitten, and then promptly puked all over the entire store, basically. You know, the cash register, the peep
projectile
jerky,
vomit.
Lottery tickets, the works.
You survived.
Yeah.
Why did you survive?
Pardon?
Why did you survive? In fact, why have you survived all of the 20, is it 26?
Well, it was 26 at the time of the writing of the book, but then I was trying some new sea snake gloves last year, and a sea snake that was tangled up in a net got through the gloves, but it had used up all its venom chewing on the net, so that one sort of counts. So technically, it'd be 27 snake bites.
Are you courting death?
Oh, no, you know, I'm already married to death. You know, I have a wife who's basically a trained Soviet killer. So, you know, easily
true,
the most
folks.
Dangerous creature I've ever met. But no, it's not any kind of, you know, suicidal passion. It's, I'm just drawn to these animals. And it's no different than like people who do, for example, Formula One racing, where Michael Schumacher wrecked a number of cars along the way and then ironically ended up with his most catastrophic injury coming from the innocuous activity of skiing.
Yeah.
So,
tragic.
You know, it goes to show, you know, that sort of thing, that sometimes the riskiest activities end up being the most pedestrian of activities.
Let's look at the science, though, because the science of venoms is fascinating, and you've moved on from snakes because you did actually develop an intolerance to their venom and an allergic reaction.
Yeah, severe allergy to the snake venom.
But back in the day, when you land in Australia, you know, home to some wonderful venomous snakes, you were looking at some of the therapeutic possibilities of venom. What are some of those possibilities?
Well, a good example is if you know of anybody who takes high blood pressure medication, odds are they're taking a class of compound related to the drug captopril, which is the founding member of this drug class. And that's a modified snake toxin that was done in 1976. Mm. It remains today a $10 billion a year market, you know, whose importance cannot be overstated. It has actually been one of the top 20 drugs of all time. But we can only develop those kinds of drugs if the animals are still around. You know, that these kinds of venomous creatures need to be looked at as a resource to be preserved. That, you know,
here's the very tension that we were talking about in the first half of the show.
Exactly. And that's where, like, when I have my students, you know, they'll ask me, you know, what can we do to get people to understand the value of conservation? I always say, your weakest argument is to talk about how beautiful or wonderful creature X, Y, or Z is. You know, that they are not, no one's going to appreciate this who doesn't already think that way. You're preaching to the choir. If you're trying to convince very right-wing people who want to just chop it all down and put up a parking lot, you have to point to the fact that, you know, the conservation through commercialization angles, that destroying these forests is no different than exploding a nuclear bomb on an oil field. No, you have destroyed a vast resource that's irreplaceable. So with the snakes or any venomous animal, there's an infinite number of things that can come out of them. We have even have experimental treatments for dementia using a scorpion peptide. But we can only do those sorts of things if we have the resource available to us.
At one point, you threw a spanner in the works when you turned to Komodo dragons. Amazing how passionate the scientific community is about Komodo dragons. What was the belief about them, and how did your work challenge it?
Well, this is my sort of climate change denier moment, in the sense that when we were disproving that Komodo dragons actually use toxic bacteria as a weapon, which they don't, we ran into this amazing psychological blowback. And it was interesting, because when I did my undergraduate studies, I did a molecular biology degree, but I also did a philosophy degree and a psychology degree. The philosophy, because I was interested in scientific philosophy of how these, you know, paradigms become accepted. And then that's where the psychology part came in, because being a bit of an Aspie, you know, reading people's not my strong point. So I needed the manual. And you know, my final cynical conclusion was, is that massive paradigm shifts only become accepted when the vanguard of the previous generation die out. And it ended up being ironically accurate with the Komodo dragon stuff, where what's been going on, it's just simply water buffaloes aren't from there. They were introduced by the Dutch settlers 300 years ago. They're living in a habitat that's unsuitable to them. Instead of big free-flowing marshes, the only water there is these stagnant watering holes full of their own feces in the tropical sun. Any cut is going to become infected. And that's been all of it all along. So when we published the paper basically decimating this, it took us a year-long battle to get it accepted, and then the journal sat on it for another year. But even more amazingly, when we were doing the studies, we had, like, the LA Zoo was awesome. They had some Komodo dragons that hatched. They let us take samples out of the babies immediately. Other zoos not only didn't want to participate, but rang other zoos telling them not to participate.
The politics over your finding that they are venomous lizards, they don't kill their prey with toxic bacteria, as was believed. It ended up in the New York Times. There was a rich debate. You've gone to Antarctica. You've done all sorts of incredible things, and we need another 15 minutes to talk to you. But now you're working on box jellyfish.
Yeah, we've been moving on to them, because more papers are published in a single year on snakes than have ever been published in jellyfish, and that's because of the problem of getting clean venom. So when you have jellyfish first aid, use vinegar, because it stops the stinging cells from inflicting more wound and more envenomation as they roll down. They tell you never to use ethanol because it causes them to fire immediately. So my very contrary sort of brain was thinking, well, why can't we just dip the tentacles in ethanol and get them to fire off, and we have our instant venom? And it was just that simple.
It's an amazing life that you lead, and it's going to take you interesting places, I can see. Where next?
I just got back from Brazil, from an island called Camada Grande, which has the highest concentration of venomous snakes in the world. But we want to go back and now revisit, because the snake numbers are down, and we think that's because the migratory birds are down. So we're actually going to follow the birds, spend a year and do 4 expeditions and see where they go over the 4 seasons and trace their entire migration.
Happy travels. Thank you for joining us just briefly on Life Matters today. And thank you, Dr. Brian Greig Fry, Venom Doc. Details on the Life Matters website. We are right out of time. Michael Cathcart is coming up next. It's 10 a.m. Have a great day.